The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Drew Dudley. Drew is the founder and chief catalyst of Day One Leadership, where he works with organizations around the world to increase their leadership capacity. His clients have included McDonald's, DreamWorks Animation, P&G, and JP Morgan Chase. Prior to Day One, Drew spent 8 years as the director of one of Canada's largest leadership development programs at the University of Toronto. His work has been featured in the Huffington Post, Forbes, Radio America, and TED.com, where his TED Talk has been voted one of the 15 most inspirational TED Talks of all time. He has a book. It's called This is Day One, A Practical Guide to Leadership That Matters. Drew Dudley, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Very early in your book, there was a quote that just popped out to me. You write, quote, "Leadership isn't in the big things. Leadership is in the consistent things." Unpack that for us.
Well, basically, the whole concept behind my particular approach to leadership is boiling it down to a daily thing. I think from the time we were really young, we were taught, okay, leadership is determined by awards, accolades, money over time. And if people think they're already, you know, most of the way through their life, well, I haven't gotten very far. I don't have a lot of those things. I'm not a leader, or I'm not in charge of people. I'm not a leader. What that does is it means that most people don't embrace the idea of leadership. And ultimately, what happens then is most of the leadership on the planet is coming from people who don't see themselves as leaders, people who every day engage in, you know, moments of empowerment and kindness and collaboration. And ultimately, I think the idea that leadership's in the consistent things is saying, okay, imagine that every single day before you went to bed, you had to prove that you deserved another day on this planet. And to do that, you had to pass a test, a series of questions. The thing is, you got the questions in the morning. And if you knew that in order to earn another day on the planet, you had to have answers to these questions, you would prioritize finding the answers to those questions every day, ahead of everything else, ahead of your emails and ahead of your job. It would be the first thing that you did. Well, my idea of leadership is, okay, well, those questions, what they are is your daily values, your behaviors, what it is you want to stand for. And right now, I think that we make our values, our things that we want to do to make the world better, I don't think they're non-negotiable to us. I think that we do them when we have time.
Right.
The phrase, "I'm the type of person who," people use it all the time, but that phrase is almost always followed by a lie. And what I find is that the consistent things are those things that you say, these are non-negotiable every day. If I'm the type of person who is kind, then kindness is non-negotiable. You have to be able to point to a specific thing that you did every single day. If you say, I'm the type of person who's accountable, well, prove it. Point to a specific thing every day. And the idea for me is that if we evaluate whether or not we've engaged in these non-negotiable behaviors every day, and if we have, then we were a leader that day. Ultimately, the idea isn't that we have to become president or CEO. The idea is we have to give evidence to ourselves and other people every day that we were actually the person that we want to be. And if we consistently do that, all these things that we're taught to chase in our lives, money and prestige and power, they're not actually goals. They're the natural byproducts that come to people who live their values consistently every day. And instead of focusing on where am I going to be in 5 years, simply say, hey, did I deliver on what I promised to myself and others today? And that's what I meant by that. It's, look, just string each day together knowing that you lived the core values you claim to stand for. And when you consistently do that, your leadership cannot be disputed by you or by anybody else.
Right. And you have a great story in here of when you chose a core group of your students to pick one key value and make sure that they walk the walk each day. And that this illustrates the problem with this, but also the promise of this, I think.
Yeah, what we did is one of them told me that it's a lot easier to stand up for an ideal than it is to live up to one.
Mm-hmm.
Which really I thought was pretty brilliant for a 21-year-old, and then I realized he stole it.
But that's fine.
As I've often said to my students, in leadership, you never steal an idea.
Mm-hmm.
You benchmark a best practice. So he argued that he had benchmarked this particular phrase.
There
but we decided to do a social experiment, and I gave them that power. I said, okay, if you can pick any value you want, and whichever one you pick, every single person on this campus will do one thing every day to live up to it. What value would you pick? And they chose impact. They said impact, a commitment to creating moments that cause people to feel as if they are better off for having interacted with you. And I said, I love it. I love that definition. That acknowledges that impact can be both positive and negative, but what we're seeking is the positive version. So go do it. I said, go out and do it. This is your assignment, is every day before you go home, you have to come in and prove to me that you did that. It can't just be a nice thing we claim we're going to do. Pick an actual moment. And it was a fun activity for, I think, 3 days. Because what became apparent really quickly is that when they got to my office, they had to think back over their day to try to pick a moment where this had happened. And they usually had one because they were awesome kids. But what I realized was they were using this value they claimed to be central to who we were to evaluate behavior that had already happened. They were looking back over their day. And the idea was that we wanted to use this thing we claimed to be important to us, this commitment to impact. We wanted to use it to drive our behavior, to impact decision-making in the moment. And so we changed it slightly. We adopted a couple of psychological approaches that combined our desire to consciously change our behavior, and we added these sort of unconscious motivators. And when we put it together, what we ended up doing is changing our definition of impact and our goal from, well, go out and create a moment where people walk away feeling better, to answering a very specific question. We said, in order to live that definition, all we really have to do is answer the specific question. What have I done to recognize someone else's leadership?
Mm-hmm.
Because we were a leadership program, we said, okay, leadership's on such a pedestal. If we tell someone the way they behave and the way they've impacted us and the way they treat other people inspires us, has made our lives better, if we tell them that and we call them a leader as a result, there's no way they're not going to walk away feeling better off. And so the assignment became, look, it's not general, it's not up there in the air, it's a very specific thing. Answer this question. And what happened was, because we transferred it into a question, it was top of mind. It made us feel uncomfortable that we had this unfinished task in our head. And so we started making plans to answer it. We started seizing opportunities when we did. And really, the book emerged, and leaving the university emerged because of how effective it was. That question made this stay top of mind all day. And my students destroyed that assignment. They were telling their coaches, their former teachers, mm-hmm. their parents, their best friends, every single day. They never missed a single opportunity throughout the course of the day. And they knew they were doing it at the time to recognize someone else's leadership. And the power of the moments that were created, 12 students and one instructor, when we sat down and everyone chose their favorite moment that had arisen because of this question, not a single person didn't cry by the end of it. And that was it. Like, that's what started the whole process I lay out in the book, and I've been teaching it ever since.
I love this so much. And an hour before we started taping this podcast, I had a phone call with my buddies Allison Wood Brooks and Michael Norton at Harvard. And we're talking about a project that we want to work on in January. And when they were in Chicago last, we did the session where we were teaching improv principles that they were then looking at and tying to some of the science and some of the evidence. And I thought about this with regard to, there's a very particular improv exercise in philosophy called Follow the Follower. And the idea here is you recognize in a group of people and in the game that you are all going to be leaders at a certain point, and you're going to be followers. So that's how the game is designed to flex that muscle. And you say in the book, quote, "I've learned that until people have been given that external permission to position themselves as a leader, they fear that claiming the title for themselves will demonstrate a level of cockiness and arrogance." So there indeed is a sort of a knee-jerk reluctance to lead, or on the opposite, to lead when no one is even looking for you to lead.
Yeah, and the idea of separating leader and follower, like at one point you become a leader and then that separates you from the idea of follower. Let's face it, the best leaders out there are the ones who can play both roles,
yeah,
who recognize when, okay, those around me are going to be best served by me saying, okay, here's what we're going to do, or simply by taking charge of the situation through my actions. And when you're on stage, I'm sure it's the same thing. Like,
right,
there's people that you say, okay, I'm going to step up. But also to be able to recognize when stepping back for a moment is going to allow somebody else to shine.
Yeah.
In some cases, that you can see they want to. And in other cases, to make space where someone is forced to step up, where there's a moment of silence and someone realizes, oh, wow, I better fill this, and then surprises themselves with how well they do it. This idea that leadership and followership, that you move from one to the other and then you're in the other zone, it's completely incorrect. And I think anyone who thinks they're leading and cannot identify a moment where they're actively following isn't actually leading.
Yeah, it's interesting bringing up on the stage, because I always think about this in terms of my very first cast at Second City included Stephen Colbert and Steve Carell. So obviously completely blessed. But one of the things that Carell was able to do, and we talk about it in the sports metaphor of playing without the ball, Colbert would go on these sort of like incredibly interesting intellectual rants, but Carell saying nothing but responding to everything was just a comic masterpiece. And it's not surprising to me that he's been able to transition into drama so effectively, because he is as proficient a speaker as he is a listener. And this is part of that duality that you're talking about, that you are a leader and a follower, that you are a speaker and a listener, but we don't naturally go to that.
No, and I think that I really heard, and I cannot believe that right now I am coming to a complete blank on one of my favorite actresses. And I can think of her character name, and I adore her, and I think I'm just jet-lagged, but I was listening to the West Wing Weekly just, I think, yesterday, and it was their special episode on Parks and Recreation.
Amy Poehler?
And the producer, that's it.
Yep.
Oh, I can't believe I just forgot Amy. I was just watching her last night.
Yeah.
But they said something that really blew my mind, that was such a perfect way of describing it. The producer of the show said, Amy Poehler is the greatest comedy point guard in the world.
Yeah, that's,
and
yes.
The idea that, like, what a perfect way to put
that
it,
is.
Right? Is that, like, he's just, all she did was dish. And I guess they did these takes, these fun runs, they called them, after the official scripted takes, and everybody could do whatever they wanted. And he's like, the thing is, Amy wasn't trying to be funny in those moments. Is she was just, she'd be asking the question, firing it around the table, and people would come up with things that were funny based on her question that they never would have thought of on their own. And I thought, man, that's the way I want to be thought of. And that's the way I want to teach my students, is be the best accountability point guard you possibly can. Be the best, empowerment point guard that you can. It's like, pick all these things you want out of your team and be the one who dishes them what they need to do it. And it was such a perfect way of putting it. As you were speaking about that, I thought, that's it, this idea of leaders are point guards.
And yeah.
Look, you can pour in all the points you want, man, but Steve Nash is going to be, in the Hall of Famer, because the man just dished.
Yeah, Tina Fey also did that, and it's not a coincidence that both Parks and Rec and 30 Rock were ensemble shows with a bunch of incredible character actors that both had these central actresses who were happy to dish off, even though you knew that they were capable of genius, and they're best friends, and they met here in Chicago doing improv. So there's another aspect of this book that I thought was really, I had not seen in other sort of leadership books. And it's when you talk about values. And you talk about it in such a way where you acknowledge that this, it's not only that this shit ain't easy, it's that this shit is going to hurt. And there's a quote in here, you say, quote, "This is the fundamental challenge with value-based decision making. It often results in short-term losses and unhappiness." Talk to us about that.
Yeah, we use the word values a lot. And what I discovered, especially in the education system, is that we use a lot of words that sound really good and we have never thought about what they mean. And the problem is we use those words to judge ourselves and others. Oh, that person doesn't have integrity. All right, well, just finish this sentence for me. Integrity is a commitment to what?
Yeah.
And people just stare at me blankly. What do you stand for? What are your three biggest values? Respect, integrity, and kindness. Okay, finish this sentence for me. Respect is a commitment to what? Because that sentence, needs to be followed by a verb. You have to lay out actual actions.
Yeah.
But we've been judging ourselves and others our whole lives, throwing around these words like respect and integrity and equality and courage. And we've never actually defined what any of them mean in terms of behaviors.
Mm.
And if you don't define what courage means to you, you turn it into a finish line so you know what you hit it. Like, you could be, and you probably are, embodying it through your behaviors every day of your life, but you never give yourself credit for it. And so all these moments where you're being the man or the woman that you want to be are going by unrecognized and uncelebrated. And since it's the celebrations in our lives that give us momentum and strength and pride, that's a problem. We're ignoring most of the moments where we live the things we claim to stand for. And so the importance of values and defining them is because values aren't just these, esoteric things. What they are is criteria for decision making. Like, your values and what they mean are so important to be specific about because they're what you need to use to make decisions in your life. And once you actually say, okay, these are my values, and what the book talks about is how to actually discover what they are, because we actually don't really know. And here's what they mean. Every time you got to do something, what you do is you take your options and you hold them up next to the values and you say, okay, which option is most consistent with this list? And the challenge is, and this is what gets us in trouble, is, look, often the option that's most consistent with your values, it like you said, it does suck. And it doesn't allow you to look good. And it doesn't allow you to keep the money or stay in the relationship or keep the job. But it's always the option you're happiest you chose 5 years from now. And I think we should make our decisions based on the idea that we're standing in front of a group of people 5 years from now explaining the decision. Because when you do that, you want to say, and you know what? I didn't work there anymore. And you know what? I walked away from the money. And you know what? I said, I'm sorry, I just can't support you in this. If you want to tell the story where you did the value-based, heroic thing that was hard, the challenge is, if you haven't said, these are actually my values and here's what they mean, what it means that, like, what criteria have you been using to make decisions your whole life?
Yeah.
Like, to anybody listening, if you can't say, here are my core values and here's exactly what they mean in terms of behaviors, if you don't know what they are, what criteria have you been turning to whenever you have to make a big decision for all of your life? And if you're like me, and if you're like most people on the planet, for most of our lives, you know what criteria we use to make decisions? It's this one. What will avoid the most consequences right now?
Right.
Like, that's the criteria we use to make decisions. What will avoid the most consequences right now? And the problem is that doesn't lead to courageous decisions. It doesn't lead to leadership decisions. And what I realized in my personal life is because I was using that criteria, what I really should have been saying was, I'm the type of person who makes decisions like a coward.
Yeah.
And that's not the person I wanted to be. And so that's why I put so much focus on, identifying your values, not because they sound good or because then you're self-aware or zen, but because if you haven't, you are not aware of what criteria you're using to make decisions in your life. And the judgments you make about yourself and the judgments you make about other people, you have no idea how you're making them. And that is a sort of, I don't know, that's a sort of obliviousness you just don't want to have.
Yeah, it's interesting. This comes up in the podcast a lot, this tension between relativism and absolutism, what we've lost as we've entered these urban circles and we've stopped going to church and we don't know who our neighbors are. And then on the other hand, when we're trying to grip to something that maybe doesn't exist anymore. And I think what your book does a lovely job of is sort of tending to both, which is you need to claim your values and you have to be able to say them out loud. And at the same time, that does not relieve you of understanding that things change and things progress. And there's this other aspect of this, which is that words matter, which comes up constantly in these interviews with all kinds of different people. And we have this improv exercise that we lead called Just Little, where we slip people into pairs and one person shares an accomplishment of their own and the other person has to respond using the words just and little within the framing of their response. And we do this to show how words matter and how they can diminish us. And you also have issues with this word just.
Well, yeah, as you were saying that, I thought, oh, wow. Like the power, I had no idea that existed. And,
yeah.
And I hope, like, I'm going to reference that if I can when I talk about my problem with just, because that clearly illustrates that that's something we're aware of, is that little and just are two powerful words. Because let me look at little first, if that's okay.
Please.
The word little. We interchange it with simple. Mm-hmm. And what I talk about in the book, what I talk about in my work, is that I claim that moments of compassion and moments of kindness and moments of respect and empathy are moments of leadership. They are, because they are powerful. They have a powerful impact on other human beings. But we don't call them leadership. We call them the little things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, we do those little things for people. And the problem is when we call them little, what we're doing is we're reinforcing this idea that for something to be leadership, for something to be big in general, it has to make you rich or it has to make you famous.
Right.
Otherwise, it's the little things. How on earth are we diminishing the greatest power we have, which is how we manage to impact and change the feelings of others? We call it little. What I talk about in the book is how to create these consistent, simple actions mm-hmm. each day. But simple doesn't mean little. And so the idea that you say both just and little is a really powerful in that exercise because of how those two things are interchanged in a way that I think is dangerous. When it comes to just, you know, the story I tell in the book is how someone who is incredibly important in my life diminished himself in front of me when I tried to tell him that by saying, oh, I'm just a janitor.
Yeah.
And I realized that what he was recognizing there was, you know, the whole society judges people on where they fall on the spectrum of financial compensation. He knows it and I know it. He's standing across from a CEO and best-selling author, and he's got a job that we use to scare kids. If you don't work hard enough, you'll end up as a janitor.
Yeah.
But this was the most profoundly kind man I had ever known. And yet he stood there and diminished himself in front of me. And I started to realize how many of us do that. We're using this word just. We say, we use it to describe what we do every day, you know, to try to make it seem like it's not going to be as much trouble as we know it will be. I just have to pick up the kids. I just have to do my email. I just have to go to this meeting. But all of those things take up most of our days.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started to realize, man, we are attaching this minimizing word to the things that we spend most of our lives doing. I'm just going to make dinner. I'm just going to take care of this project. Like, what does it do to our mind subconsciously to think that most of the things we do, we're minimizing constantly? And it spills over into how we talk about ourselves. I'm just middle management. I'm just a janitor. I'm just a teacher. You know, I'm just a stay-at-home mom. And my problem with the word just is that whenever we use it, we are giving people permission to expect less from us. And we are indicating that we don't particularly think that we're that important. And one of my real strong arguments with my students and anybody who will listen is leaders never allow someone who is a person of worth to diminish themselves in front of you. Don't do it. The next time you hear that word come out of your mouth or somebody else's, ask, was that just used as a diminisher?
Mm.
And if it was, call it. Like, call it, like, politely tell the other person they're not just anything, or admit to yourself that you just allowed yourself to diminish who you are. And when you do that, you say to everyone else, yeah, you can do it too.
Right. Well, you know,
it's so cool you have that exercise.
Yeah. Well, because to get over the stuff, you have to practice it. I mean, you know, you can read about anything. But what we know about the best kind of learning, especially if it's habit changing learning, is that it takes practice and it hurts a little bit. So when you have to talk about something you love, and then the person across from you knows that they have to use those Justin Little words, it doesn't matter that they're role playing. They know what they're doing in terms of the diminishment, and you feel it no matter what. And so the sort of the benign quality of that exercise creates what I think is a much more powerful way for someone to understand how they can take away someone's agency.
Thanks for teaching me that. That's
sure,
amazing.
But please use it. And this relates to this idea, and you mentioned it before, about courage. And you have a great story in the book about a couple of young entrepreneurs who wanted to develop courage and resilience. And I want you to tell this because I remember reading this and then going, I stopped. I go, I want to tell you this story out of this book I'm reading to my 21-year-old son. And he loved it. I just think this is great.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is this story itself is a testament to the power of storytelling.
Yeah.
In that, you know, a friend of mine told me once that the story is the basic unit of human understanding. And when you could tell a story that helps people understand something in their own lives, and you have no idea who your stories are going to touch, mm-hmm. it gets passed on. And the stories of these two young entrepreneurs came, I realize now, from a TED Talk by a guy named Zha Jiang, and you can look that up online. Mm-hmm. And he got it from a Canadian entrepreneur. And what they told me was, look, they're in the tech space. And for me, working in the tech space is insane because anything that you create immediately is outmoded, right? So why would you put yourself in a world where whatever you create, you immediately pretty much have to start tearing down and building something new? I thought it takes so much guts to build a company in a world where that has to happen, where you are never going to be able to slow down. So I asked the two of them, how do you do that? Like, how do you have the courage to build a company and tie your careers to having to constantly succeed like that? And they taught me about rejection therapy. And they said, when they're geeks, and they admitted they were geeks, you're always afraid of rejection, they said. And but if you are afraid of having your ideas rejected, you will never offer them.
Mm-hmm.
And ideas that aren't offered aren't actually ideas. They're just thoughts. And he said, so if you suck at something and you want to not suck anymore, you have to practice. And I thought, what a simple, like, really simple truth, right?
But mm-hmm.
if you suck at something and you would no longer like to suck, you must practice. And so they said, we realized we had to practice rejection. And so we do rejection therapy. And I said, well, what does it look like? Like, what does that actually mean? And they said, we pick one day every month and we dedicate 24 hours to try to be rejected as many times as possible in that 24-hour period. And I said, okay, well, tell me what do you actually do that day? And he said, you know, I walk up to the most beautiful people I can find and I say, hey, do you want to have dinner with me? And the thing that he told me that I always remember is he said, they always say the same thing. They always say, I don't even know you.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yeah, but I spend one day every month trying to be rejected as many times as possible. It makes me a better man.
Hmm.
And he said, you know what? That's really interesting. And interesting is more important than being hot.
Yeah.
And I've always joked that we need to put that on the wall of every high school. And, you know,
totally.
They'll walk into Subway and say, can I make my own sandwich? They said there's three things we really learned. One, you're not rejected as often as you think you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, it's an effort sometimes, especially in Canada, because we're super polite.
Yeah.
Two, when you are rejected and you're trying to be, it actually feels like an accomplishment. Like, it actually feels good because you actually succeeded at something. And eventually that just spills over into the rest of your life whenever you do it on an off day. And he said, and this might be, you know, this may be a Canadian thing, but he said, even when you're rejected, you are almost always offered something better than what you currently have. And he commented that they used to ask police if they could shoot stop signs, like in Superbad.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, nobody's ever allowed us to do that. But a couple of them have allowed us to drive around their squad cars. And so, you know, that idea of rejection therapy, I turned it, you know, what my process does, it turns specific goals into questions. And so I turned that into, you know, what have I tried today that might not work, but tried anyway? And I'll tell you, that question has changed my life in a lot of ways. You know, I get to ride in a private jet. I get to eat at Michelin star chef's tables, make announcements on planes, drive race cars. And, you know, honestly, I met the love of my life because of that question. And it really is a game changer to go out and say, what have I tried today that might not work, but tried anyway? And I mean, if you're on the stage, you know that the decision you make in that split second, do I go for this or not? You know, sometimes it's going to fall flat. But I bet you any money, the biggest laughs you've ever gotten are when you thought, oh, this may not go. And then you take a swing and then it just flies out of the park. So
yeah,
that question's a game changer, whether you're, you know, doing improv or in business or, you know, thinking about walking across the room and saying, you know, can I buy you a drink or a house? It is a game changer.
Yeah. There's another exercise that we do, which ties to this. And we basically teach everyone in a group, say we have 30 people in a workshop, to tell this joke in this format. It's called 1001. And, someone throws out an object. Let's say they say plumber. You go, okay, 1001 plumbers walk into a bar. The bartender says, we don't serve plumbers. The plumbers say back to them, well, we'll just flush our stuff out of here. Something terrible like that. And the job of everyone, in the audience, because every single person is going to get up there and do this joke off the top of their head with whatever someone shouts out, the job of the audience is always to applaud like crazy. And what you discover by doing this is that even though you might have nothing, you get these applause. And so you start trying anything. And this is what, certainly in stand-up comedy, which is not my forte. My forte is improvisation. But in stand-up comedy, there is so much bombing that goes on. And it's why that they go and play these clubs and do 15 minutes late at night, because it kind of doesn't matter. And you get used to bombing. And that allows you then to try more and more and more. And you're going to get to the good jokes. You mostly are going to get there. But it does take time. And you write in here, courage takes practice. Nothing that was worthwhile didn't hurt. That's working out. That's love. That's been my experience. And like writing a book, you know this, right? I mean, writing a book is painful. It is not a happy process most of the time. But those are the things that are worthwhile.
Yeah, a buddy of mine told me that, hey, Drew, you'll finish your book when you give up on the idea that you'll ever like your book. And you know what? It was seriously maybe the best advice I got in the process of writing this thing.
Oh, I wish I'd had that. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Okay, we're coming close to the end of the podcast, and I am going to ask you for a yes and story to end the podcast, but I want to ask you a question before that.
Sure.
And I pulled a quote here that I just loved. You say in the book, quote, I don't know the key to happiness, but unhappiness is inevitable when you allow a gap to form between your conception of who you are and how you behave. That seems profoundly true, that really it's in that sort of chasm is where the unhappiness is.
Yeah, it's in the book I talk about how I became aware of my gap there because of a 7-year-old, because they're relentless in their questions and you can't BS a 7-year-old. But yeah, and what I've found is that leadership, honestly, is recognizing the gap exists, acknowledging that's your fault, and then recognizing also that it's completely within your power to at least close it a little bit.
Yeah.
And if you create a plan every day to close the gap between the person you want to be and how you're behaving, it's leadership, full stop.
Yep.
And if you consistently do it, there's where it is, right? It's in that mm-hmm. consistent commitment to finding a way to close the gap, even a little bit, between who you want to be and how you're behaving. And if you dedicate yourself to that every day, that's personal leadership. You're living it, and we got to give ourselves credit for it.
Yeah, because you're never gonna close it completely. That's That's no. insane thinking.
It's the same thing as the book, right? You will be happy with yourself when you give up on ever being happy with yourself.
Right. Okay. So we always ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, if groups of people are making something out of nothing, they can't really do that at all if they say no. But just saying yes isn't enough. They have to say yes and. And I'm wondering in your life, in your work, and this feels like a softball question for you based on reading the book, was there a moment when you were going to say no, but instead said yes and what happened?
Yeah, you know, the book is dedicated to a woman named Anastasia, who I was very much in love with, and is the woman who made me promise to actually try to release it. But what's interesting is the book was written, every love story has a bump, right? That's what makes them interesting stories. Like, if there's no tension in a story, then there's no payoff. And in one brief time in our time together, you know, we did something to hurt each other. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I was hurt very bad, and there was a short gap when we were apart. And I was just heartbroken. I was just destroyed. And I couldn't leave. I just didn't want to leave my apartment. And I sat down and I wrote that first draft of the book. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, after I'd been hurt. And then, you know, she reaches out and says, you know, can we get together? Can we talk? And I remember going to wait for her and sitting there on the bench thinking, okay, I'm ready to feel a million different things when she comes around the corner. I'm ready to feel jealous. I'm ready to feel enraged. I'm ready to feel nothing. And I was all prepared for all of these different emotions. And what I wasn't prepared for is when she came around the corner and all I felt was like, absolute love, right? And none of it mattered. I had thought of all of these things I was going to say and do to sort of punish her for doing something that hurt me. And as soon as she came around the corner, I was floored by the fact that none of it mattered. And I remember in the conversation, I talked to him like, there's no way I'm going to let her get away with this. And just being a dick, right? Like all that things where instead of recognizing how you feel, you just focus on how you were hurt. And I remember she said, you know, can you forgive me for what I did and stay friends? And I said, yes, and I can love you still. And that, it led to the best time in my life being with her after that. And I just remember, I'm like, there is no way that I'm going to allow myself to feel like that again, because, you know, I was hurt. And, just to hold on to the hurt instead of embracing everything that had come before it. I didn't understand. I just remember her saying, you know, can you forgive me? And can you still, you know, be friends with me? And I just was like, yes, and I can still love you. And when that moment, like all the time that happened after that, her encouraging me to get the book out there, making me promise to get the book out there. None of that would have happened if in that moment I just allowed my hurt to make me say no. And, you know, she made me promise to write the book. She died by suicide 17 days later.
Oh, my God.
And but I'll tell you, as awful as that is, between that moment where I found a way to say yes and, I mean, well, she just has that power over me. But, and when she was gone, were the best days of my life. And I could have thrown them away in that moment. And I'm so glad that not only did I say, yeah, we can be friends, but because everything inside me said, don't be that. Like,
right.
Don't just be like, don't just say it. Don't say, I still love you. Like, make her work for it. Like, that we've all been through this before when you're hurt by somebody else. But man, since that moment to the time she died were the absolute best days of my life. And it's because of that.
That's an unbelievable story. The book is called This Is Day One, A Practical Guide to Leadership That Matters. Drew Dudley, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was truly a pleasure.
Down, working in a coal mine. Oh, I can slip down, working in a coal mine.
Singapore.